Hi, this is Cheyenne with General Neurology Podcast. This is episode 3, series 1 of Cranial Nerves. Today I'm going to be focusing on cranial nerve 5, which is the trigeminal nerve. The trigeminal nerve is the largest cranial nerve. It contains sensory and motor component. The sensory territory including the face and head anterior to the vertex, the mucous membrane of the oral and nasal cavities, paranasal sinuses, the teeth, intracranial vessels, and finally, the dura of the anterior and middle cranial fossae. And we also have the motor component, which supplies the muscles of the mastication. Now we're going to talk about examination. The motor and sensory function of the trigeminal nerve need to be examined separately. Sensory examination should include examination of the three divisions of the nerve and comparison to be made with the other side. The cutaneous sensation, including light touch, pinprick, and temperature, should all be tested. Again, in practice, the temperature sensation is often quickly assessed with a cold metal tuning fork, asking if the patient can appreciate the cool temperature of the metal against the facial skin. Again, it's quite important to remember that the angle of the jaw is usually outside the trigeminal territory, and the V1, which is the ophthalmic division, includes the side of the nose and extends to the back of the vertex. And interestingly, the back of the scalp and the angle of the jaw are supplied by C2-C3 dermatome. Therefore, non-organic patterns of sensory loss may include the angle of the jaw or stop at the hairline. Once again, it's important to take this interpretation with extra caution because you could have patients with similar patterns of sensory loss which has an underlying organic cause such as syringomyelia. Now let's talk about the corneal reflex. The corneal reflex is elicited with a wisp of cotton wool or sometime by wafting air gently over the cornea while shielding the other eye. So essentially we have the afferent and efferent arc. So the afferent arc is mediated by the ophthalmic nerve, which is the V1, for the upper cornea, and V2, which is the maxillary nerve, for the lower portion of the cornea. And the efferent arc is via the facial nerve, which causes blinking, and the nervous intermedius, which is to do with the tearings or lacrimation. In a normal corneal response, you would expect to get a bit of discomfort when the cornea is touched. Sometime it could accompany with, lacrimation or tearing, sometime even conjunctival injection. And the abnormalities of the corneal reflex are an early sensitive sign of trigeminal nerve sensory dysfunction. So a neurophysiological recording of the related blink reflex may be useful where you're trying to quantify an abnormality. And this is particularly useful when you are trying to distinguish between upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron lesion. So you could have a patient with a Bell's palsy. Of course, you know that the forehead is spurred in upper motor neuron lesion. You could also do a corneal reflex where if it's a Bell's palsy, which is a lower motor neuron lesion, you would expect the corneal reflex to be absent. However, in an upper motor neuron lesion, someone with a stroke, if you do a corneal reflex, it should still be preserved. Another important fact to remember is that the tactile sensory loss on the face in the absence of a reduced or absent corneal reflex should really raise a suspicion of a non-organic cause. Parietal lobe lesion, which is involving the perisylvian portion of the postcentral gyrus, can cause depression of the contralateral corneal sensation. When examining the motor component of the trigeminal nerve, the muscles of mastication are tested first by asking the patient to clench the jaw, and essentially you palpate the muscles in the masseter and temporalis and looking for fasciculation or wasting of the muscles. Strength of jaw opening and lateral deviation against resistance are also examined. So if there is a unilateral lesion, it causes jaw deviation towards the affected side. This is because of the contralateral pterygoid contraction. And or you could have an ability to deviate the jaw to the opposite side. The jaw jerk is elicited with the jaw relaxed and slightly open. The afferent arc is via stretch receptors in V3, which is the mandibular nerve, and the efferent arc via the trigeminal motor fibers. So if you get an absent jaw jerk it's not really helpful. It doesn't tell you anything really. If you get an exaggerated Georgia response, it indicates bilateral supranuclear lesion of the cortical bulbar pathway, rostral to the pons, for example, in pseudobulbar palsy. Now we're going to talk about the peripheral fifth nerve lesion. Lesions of the individual division and peripheral branches produce well-demarcated areas of sensory loss on the face and sometimes considerable pain. Trauma is a frequent cause. The supraorbital and infraorbital branches of V1, which is the ophthalmic nerve, are among the nerves most commonly affected. Numbness of half of the tongue accompanied by occipital and upper neck pain and head turning is a classic feature of a syndrome called neck tongue syndrome, which is believed to be caused by compression of the ventral ramus of C2, which carries sensory fibers from the tongue via the hypoglossal nerve. The ophthalmic, maxillary, and mandibular division may be affected individually or in combination as they exit the skull base by malignant meningeal infiltration, infective or even meningeal processes via granulomas or bony metastases in the skull. The trigeminal schwannomas may also arise from the region of the trigeminal ganglion, either as an isolated tumor or part of the spectrum of neurofibromatosis type 2. And the trigeminal nerve may also be involved in the cerebellopontine angle syndrome. There's another funny syndrome called numb chin syndrome, which is, again, an important syndrome to remember. It causes unilateral sensory disturbances affecting the chin and the lower lip, and usually is indicative of a bony metastasis in the mandible involving the mental nerve. And also can be a feature of a breast or prostate cancer recurrence, lymphoma, or even myeloma. There's another condition to think about is the superior orbital fissure syndrome, which basically involves third, fourth, and sixth cranial nerve. It typically present with ophthalmoplegia, accompanied by sensory disturbance and often pain in the V1 distribution, which is the ophthalmic nerve, sometimes in combination with proptosis with large orbital lesion. Horner's syndrome and visual loss may also occur if the sympathetic supply to the eye or optic nerve become involved, the latter suggesting extension to the orbital apex. Tumors such as nasopharyngeal cancers, trauma, infections, for example from an epidural abscess, or even inflammatory disorders such as sarcoidosis are often the cause of this syndrome. Another interesting syndrome to talk about is the cavernous sinus syndrome, which is clinically indistinguishable from the superior orbital fissure syndrome that we talked about previously, except that the V2 as well as V1 may be involved in the cavernous sinus syndrome. Proptosis doesn't occur except in the cases of carotid cavernous fistulas, again involvement of both the oculomotor nerve and the sympathetic supply to the eye may result in mid-position non-reactive pupil, or the pupil may be dilated or myotic because of the parasympathetic or sympathetic involvement in isolation. The cavernous sinus syndrome can be caused by a variety of possible pathologies, including tumors, which typically happen from metastases like meningiomas or nasopharyngeal carcinoma. It could be caused by aneurysm of the intracavernous portion of the carotid artery, carotid cavernous fistula, or from inflammatory condition, things like TB, which I've actually seen in practice, causes a syndrome called Toulouse-Hunt syndrome. We've had a patient who presented with worsening headache and cranial nerve six palsy, which we done a lumbar puncture, and we identified TB in the CSF. We treated her with steroid and antibiotics, and she significantly improved with steroid first, and she need to continue taking antibiotic for a longer period of time. Sometimes they can reoccur, but the main thing not to miss is to make sure that there's no cavernous sinus thrombosis, which is a very serious condition, and it's something that you shouldn't miss really. Now to end the podcast, I'm going to talk about the most common disorder of the trigeminal nerve, which is called trigeminal neuralgia. I've seen it in practice many times. although it's not a life-threatening condition, it can be extraordinarily distressing for patients. The prevalence is very difficult to determine. The incident is approximately 4 in 100,000 per year. Women are more frequently affected than men. It's usually idiopathic. However, it could be caused by neurovascular compression, which also typically starts in the 6th and 7th decades. And younger patients are more likely to have symptomatic trigeminal neuralgia. And you always need to rule out a secondary cause to this condition, such as multiple sclerosis and occasionally a mass lesion. So what are the clinical features of trigeminal neuralgia? Well, it has quite a characteristic pain consisting of excruciating, lancinating paroxysm in the face. The pain is severe, often described as shooting, stabbing, electric shock-like pain, and patients describe it as the worst pain they've ever experienced in their life. Paroxysm lasts for a few seconds or minute at most. They tend to occur in bouts, sometimes with such frequency that paroxysm become indistinct, often with a refractory period of several minutes seen after each attack. And the duration of the attacks are, you know, relatively proportional to the severity and the length of paroxysm. Again, during the attack, the face may contort, hence the name tic douloureux. Patients are usually pain-free between attacks, but in some cases, it could be superimposed with a dull pain in the background. And again, that is a sign of a poor response to treatment. And these patients typically present with some sort of a trigger. And in terms of trigger, you know, it could be by talking, chewing, or often exposing the face to wind. It's quite characteristic. I had a patient presented with excruciating pain that she was avoiding eating, talking, and even letting us examine the mouth itself. So you can imagine how painful this condition is, and we really need to empathize and sympathize with them. So in trigeminal neuralgia, the mandibular and maxillary territory are far more commonly affected than the ophthalmic division. So the ophthalmic division is about 5% of the population with trigeminal neuralgia. And the red flag to remember here, if you got a patient with a bilateral trigeminal neuralgia, which is quite rare, about 3% of the population, they're usually caused by intrinsic brainstem pathologies such as demyelination. So they need to have an MRI to look for any demyelinating lesion. Again, patient could have remission for a month or even years, but the pain almost always recurs. Successive bouts tends to be worse and more frequent with shorter remission, and the pain may spread to affect a wider area of face over time, typically commencing in the V3 distribution and moving to include V2 and V1. And because of the severity of the attacks, patients become fearful during the remission that the pain will return. Examination can be quite difficult. They're always worried that if you examine them, you could trigger another attack. So you got to be very reassuring and try to avoid any triggers that they know about. And in terms of diagnosis, it can be quite challenging, particularly for the primary care physicians. Again, you could have patients with typical sign of trigeminal neuralgia, but if you see any red flag, you need to do further investigation to make sure there's no other underlying causes for this. Most patients see the dentist initially and may have had some dental work with no improvement in pain before the diagnosis of trigeminal neuralgia is made. And when you see a patient with similar symptom, other differentials should come to your mind, such as acute glaucoma, sinusitis, giant cell arthritis, or even angina with referred jaw pain. Temporal mandibular joint dysfunction causing facial pain is rarely like trigeminal neuralgia, and is usually associated with jaw movements and is probably overdiagnosed. The trigeminal autonomic cephalgias, such as cluster headache, typically affect only the eye and surrounding area and usually easily differentiated from trigeminal neuralgia. A useful distinguishing feature is the duration of the attack. So in trigeminal neuralgia, it's typically less than 5 seconds. But again, it can be very difficult to distinguish other conditions such as short-lasting unilateral neuralgia form headache with conjunctival injection called SUNCT, so S-U-N-C-T, which is a rare headache disorder characterized by extremely frequent attacks of unilateral head pain and autonomic activation. And compared to trigeminal neuralgia, the pain typically lasts from 5 seconds to 5 minutes. To make things even more complicated, you could have a patient with idiopathic stabbing headache, which also could be part of the differential diagnosis of V1 trigeminal neuralgia. Trigeminal neuralgia is frequently associated with depression or anxiety background, although this shouldn't necessarily imply a causal relationship. Okay, now let's talk about the etiology and pathogenesis of trigeminal neuralgia. The main risk factors for apparently idiopathic trigeminal neuralgia are age and occasionally a history of hypertension. However, there's increasing evidence that in many years, trigeminal neuralgia is caused by compression of the trigeminal nerve root at or near the dorsal root entry zone by an ectatic vascular loop, often of the superior cerebellar artery. Abnormal ephaptic, non-synaptic transmission between trigeminal axon within areas of focal demyelination caused by compression of the nerve has been proposed as a substrate of the pain with increased excitability of the trigeminal brainstem complex. High-resolution MRI studies demonstrate a distinct vascular loop in contact with the nerve in some cases. Other cerebellopontine angle masses, including tumors such as vestibular schwannomas, meningiomas, and even aneurysm, may sometimes compress the nerve. Intrinsic brainstem pathology, particularly plaques of pontine demyelination in patients with MS, can cause symptomatic trigeminal neuralgia, which is occasionally bilateral. So again, that is the red flag. Patients with MS have a 20 times higher risk of developing trigeminal neuralgia. Up to 5% of patients with MS develop trigeminal neuralgia and occasionally is a presenting symptom of MS. And rarely, small infarct in the dorsal root entry zone in the pons or infiltration of the trigeminal nerve or ganglion by amyloid or tumours may lead to trigeminal neuralgia. Bear in mind, MRI is not an essential investigation in typical cases of trigeminal neuralgia. However, increasingly carried out when patients are very worried or have a significant family history of tumours or inflammatory condition. Okay, now let's talk about the treatment for trigeminal neuralgia. Until the advent of modern treatment, patients were sometimes driven to suicide by severity and distress of trigeminal nerve pain. A variety of effective medical and surgical treatment now exists, but evidence supporting the use is often observational rather than based on rigorous data. So carbamazepine has been the first-line drug for trigeminal neuralgia for a long time and is effective, or at least partially effective, in 70% of cases. So in practice, the most challenging part is achieving an effective therapeutic dose as quickly enough. And again, the side effects are often encountered in elderly patients when rapid titration regimens are used. So in these cases, oxcarbazepine is used increasingly as first or second line drug. It is as effective as carbamazepine and can be increased to an effective therapeutic dosage much more rapidly and is often better tolerated, especially in elderly patients. Other agents used in practice, either alone or combination, include lamotrigine, baclofen, gabapentin, and a variety of other anticonvulsant drugs. And sometimes phenytoin, for example, is used in a very acute phase where you get a refractory trigeminal neuralgia. For patients with drug-resistant trigeminal neuralgia, or when medication are not well-tolerated, a surgical approach is indicated. In general, surgery tend to be more effective than medical therapy. There's increasing trends now towards early surgical intervention because sustained remission is the exception, and the natural history studies indicate that the trigeminal neuralgia often becomes gradually more severe with time and also resistant to medical therapy. Actually, about half of all trigeminal neuralgia patients will require surgery at some stage. Now, the gasserine ganglion ablative techniques have been around for quite a while now, and these techniques involve selective ablation of part of the trigeminal ganglion using a percutaneous approach via foramen ovale by radio frequency thermal coagulation or balloon microcompression. And these procedures are typically done as a day cases or even with a short inpatient stay, and they tend to have a low morbidity and immediate efficacy. Gamma knife radiosurgery is another technique which involves high doses of focused irradiation at either the root exit zone or the nerve itself within the pontine system proximal to the gasserine ganglion, and the success rate for pain relief are reasonable, but it may sometimes delay for several months, and the long-term result and complication are not yet known. So this brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to my very long podcast, and I hope it managed to cover some of the basic of the anatomy that you should know as a student or as even a clinician. If you would like me to cover any other topics apart from cranial nerves in future, just leave a comment on my neurology page, which is neurology.pa on Instagram. See you next week.